Chapter 5, Flu and Pandemics. This chapter is a biggie and has generated quite a bit of interest with recent coverage of the swine flu. There's more writing and fewer exercises, and there are a few items that you're going to want to buy as soon as possible. We're going to cover a lot of ground, and I'm going to do my best to give you thorough answers while keeping the chapter readable and at a fast pace. At the end, I'll direct you to some additional in-depth resources. Now, I've consulted doctors, naturopaths, a bioweapons expert who studied under the head of the Soviet bioweapons program, and a geneticist who specializes in viruses for this chapter. Like you, I'm particularly concerned about whether or not the threat is real, how to avoid the threat, and how to deal with it if it becomes a reality. To begin with, let's talk about what the flu is and briefly decipher what all of the letters and numbers associated with the swine flu actually mean. Swine flu is a virus that affects the respiratory system and is caused by the type A influenza virus. Now, there's five types of flus, and type A is by far the most common and the only one that we'll address today. One of our seasonal flus is the H1N1 version of the virus, and this year's A H1N1 virus is basically an adapted version of our normal flu that has genetic materials from the pig version of the flu. Virus adaptation is a normal process, and all flus adapt to one extent or another as a means of self-preservation so that they will be able to infect people who have developed natural immunity to a previous strain. The H and the N are simply the first letters of two proteins that make up the flu virus. I may butcher this, but they're hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, and I'll spell those for you in case you want to know how to spell them. They are hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. And basically, it's easier to say and write A H1N1 than it is to write type A hemagglutinin type 1 neuraminidase type 1. And swine flu is even simpler, but they all mean the same thing this flu season. Now, the numbers are different versions of the proteins. So the A H1N1 virus is simply the type A flu with the type 1 hemagglutinin protein and the type 1 neuraminidase protein. Overall, there are 19 types of flus that have been identified, and 12 types have caused human deaths. The AH1N1 is the same version of the flu that caused the 1918 flu pandemic, but same is somewhat of an overstatement. While both versions of the virus were type H1N1, the 1918 version was much more aggressive than the current one has been so far. That being said, this version of the H1N1 virus is potentially deadly because it carries a swine version of the H1 protein that's different from the human H1 protein that many people have already developed immunity for. So how does the flu form? Well, the origins of flus in general, and swine flu in particular, are debatable. Actually, very debatable. But the most accepted theory is that the virus lives normally in birds without causing any problems. And when birds are in close proximity to pigs, occasionally the virus will infect a pig. As the pig's immune system fights off the virus changes genetically to survive, and then the virus is able to spread from pig to pig. This is the case with the H1N1 virus. It was fairly stable in pigs for several decades, passing freely from pig to pig, but with only a few isolated human infections. Now, pigs and humans are both susceptible to type H1 and H2 viruses. So when a bird passes one of those types of the flu to a pig, and the pigs are in close proximity to humans, the virus has a chance to make additional adaptations to survive in humans. The H1N1 virus did this in 1998 by combining the existing proteins from bird flu, swine flu, and adding proteins from human flu. This process can occur anywhere humans are in close contact with pigs and pig waste. Two primary situations are near pork production facilities and in cultures where pigs are seen as part of the family and sleep in the same area where people do. This is most common in Southeast Asia, and the chain of events that has caused many of our widespread flus is fairly straightforward. In the springtime, farmers, some of who have contracted the flu from their livestock in Southeast Asia, travel and get together in large groups for livestock fairs, Chinese New Year celebrations, Easter celebrations in the Philippines, and other springtime holidays. These large gatherings allow the flu to spread from human to human and get spread through the region and internationally. typically flu seasons are worse during rainy years because people spend more time indoors. And the key thing here is that they're away from UV light and they're in closer proximity to other people. So why was the 2009 flu originally called the Mexican flu? Well, there's a couple of theories on this. First, if you've noticed in your grocery stores, a lot of produce now comes from Mexico. This isn't just a U.S. phenomenon. China also buys much of their produce from Mexico, and one theory is that the swine flu was transferred from China to Mexico by Mexican farmers attending a produce conference in China early in the spring of 2009. They may or may not have been symptomatic before spreading the virus. And second, it's very possible that the 2009 strain made the jump from pigs to humans in Mexico. The first identified patients, or patient zero, with this strain of the flu were believed to be from La Gloria, a town of 3,000 people and 15,000 pigs east of Mexico City. Almost 30% of the town suffered from flu-like symptoms, and three young children died shortly before Easter 2009. Everything changed when people traveled to visit relatives for Easter. Within a week, people started coming down with the H1N1 virus across Mexico, and soon, thanks to international travel,
we may never know where
this
strain truly made the jump from pig to man.
No country wants to take credit for it, and the cities and facilities in question have made it difficult for researchers to determine the origin for the exact same reason. In reality, it's fun trivia, but if you get the flu, it really won't matter where it came from. It won't matter whether it started in China or Mexico, and so I urge you to not get too hung up on it. In any case, the theories have parallels. First of all, they both involve people living close to pigs and/or pig waste. Second, the virus makes a jump from pigs to human. And third, the virus makes the jump from person to person. And fourth, the infected people travel and spread the virus. Now, I want to give you a brief history of flu pandemics and pandemic scares. Just so you know what the words mean, pandemics are simply epidemics that cover a large area and affect a large percentage of the population. Now, epidemics are infections that spread rapidly among a population. So said another way, pandemics are infections that spread rapidly among a population and cover a large geographical area. The 1918 flu pandemic is the most commonly cited flu, and there are some pertinent facts that are important today since they're both H1N1 strains. First of all, it had up to a two-week incubation period, but killed in as fast as 2 to 3 days of getting symptoms, which was way too fast for the medicines of the time to help. Number two, although called the Spanish flu, it's believed to have made the jump from pig to human either in China or on a U.S. pig farm in Kansas and spread to Spain by U.S. troop. Now, this is similar to the possible misnaming of the Mexican flu. Third, it's estimated that 500 million of the world's 1.8 billion people contracted the flu, and that it killed between 25 and 50 million, although some estimates are as high as 100 million. Very few people died of the flu, but rather most died from secondary infections, including strep pneumonia. Number five, the virus showed up initially in the spring, went dormant in the summer, and exploded for 8 weeks in the fall, went dormant again, and then reemerged in the spring of 1919. Normally, people with bad strains stay home and recover while people with mild strains continue their normal activities, spreading the mild strain. In 1918, soldiers at war didn't have the option to stay home and therefore spread the more deadly strain. Well, modern application of this is people crowding doctors' offices and emergency rooms with flu-like symptoms. Some people will have nothing, some will have mild strains and weakened immune systems, and others will have the more severe strain and spread it to the others who will be released to go back to their daily lives. Fast forwarding, the 1957 flu pandemic was a type H2N2 from pigs and was much milder than the 1918 virus, killing only 2 million worldwide. Interestingly enough, the H2N2 virus hasn't had a widespread reach since the 1968 flu season. Now, testing equipment, medical reporting, and international communication had improved significantly since 1918, and because of that, there were a few key lessons learned. First of all, schools were the most effective incubators of the virus in the US and UK, infecting as many as 90% of the students. Number two, the virus didn't spread in US schools until they opened in the fall. And number three, this is really interesting, the virus died out by early December, and in late January, early February, it reemerged in the elderly population. Number four, infection rates were highest among people who attended large indoor gatherings, such as school events. And number five, the staph pneumonia mortality rate was as high as 28%, and regularly killed people within 48 hours of being admitted to the hospital because the antibiotics at the time just didn't start working fast enough. Fast forwarding again, the 1968 flu pandemic was a type H3N2 from pigs and was even milder than the 1957 pandemic, killing 1 million people worldwide. The main takeaway from the 1968 flu was that it's thought that one of the reasons it was milder than the 1957 flu is that it didn't reach its peak until Christmas 1968, which when children were home on break, thus limiting the spread in schools. The 1976 flu, otherwise known as the non-pandemic, is an example of what many fear for future flu seasons. A massive vaccination campaign was launched in fear of a pandemic, and the result was $1.3 billion in lawsuits by people who were paralyzed by the vaccine, 25 deaths, hundreds of people who were struck with the Guillain-Barré syndrome, and no pandemic or even an epidemic happened anywhere in the world. Now let's look at modern day factors. It's important to realize that the regular flu kills about 1 million people every year and doesn't make the news. In addition, malaria kills 3,000 people every day and is not considered newsworthy either. Even so, your friends and coworkers probably aren't worried about malaria as much as the swine flu. So let's take a look at how it spreads, some bad, albeit popular, ways to fight the flu, and some strategies that are actually effective in preventing and fighting the flu. The first one I want to look at is N95 masks. And I have N95 masks, both in my house and in my vehicles, but they're not for the flu. Rather, I have them to protect me from airborne contaminants in the event of a local disaster or terrorist attack. Now, you might ask why I don't like the N95 masks for flu protection. Well, to begin with, the flu virus is relatively weak and is killed quickly by sunlight or UV rays. People who wear masks normally wear them when they're outdoors, where the virus will be killed quickly by the sun. The time to wear masks is indoors, but even then it doesn't make sense. When a person with the flu sneezes, their spittle stays airborne for up to 17 minutes, and it carries the flu virus and be absorbed through the eyes. More importantly, 17 minutes gives the spittle a long time to travel. Some also ends up on flat surfaces, doorknobs, pens, etc., and you pick up the virus when you touch any one of those surfaces. Soon enough, you'll use the same hands to rub your nose, eyes, or mouth. Now, one of the biggest reasons not to trust the N95 mask is that the flu virus is smaller than the particles that the N95 masks are designed to filter. Now, the other thing is, when you have a perfectly fitted N95 mask, it still lets in about 10% of the air that you breathe from around the edges of the mask. To add icing onto the cake, the National Institute of Health doesn't even recommend that people wear them to protect themselves from the flu. In short, the most effective use of N95 masks to stop the spread of the flu virus is to have people with the flu wear them, just like surgeons do when they operate to protect people that they're operating on. Next, let's take a look at Tamiflu and Relenza. I have to preface this by saying that the topic of Tamiflu and Relenza is a very emotionally charged topic. I interviewed experts who have dozens of doses of Tamiflu on hand, and I interviewed experts who would never touch it. I've attempted to cut through the emotion on the subject and just give you the facts that you can take action on. Now, Tamiflu is an oral antiviral prescription drug, and Relenza is an inhaled antiviral designed to kill the flu virus. You can buy them for $50 to $200 per dose, and they have the big benefit of shortening the average duration of the flu by a day and a half. That's it. Just a day and a half. Now, considering the fact that secondary infections are the biggest killer associated with the flu, this is potentially a big benefit. Unfortunately, they also have many downsides. To begin with, neither Tamiflu nor Relenza actually attack or kill the flu virus. They only play defense. My geneticist friend described it this way. Picture a guy in a boat tied to a dock. The dock is one of your cells, and the guy in the boat is the flu virus. Once he destroys the dock, he wants to cut the rope and go find another dock to destroy. Tamiflu's only job is to keep the guy from cutting the rope. It won't attack the guy, and once you're done attacking or taking Tamiflu, the guy is free to go back to cutting the rope and destroying more docks. In order for Tamiflu to be effective, you have to have a healthy immune system that can come in and actually kill the virus. We'll talk about strengthening your immune system in a little bit. Now, Tamiflu also has side effects that are similar to the flu, including nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, headaches, dizziness, fatigue, seizures, and coughing. In fact, the FDA has issued warnings, and Japan has banned the use of Tamiflu on children because users between the ages of 10 and 17 were reporting additional side effects of delirium, panic attacks, hallucinations, and convulsions. We're already seeing strains of the flu that are resistant to Tamiflu, and as use increases, so will the number of Tamiflu-resistant strains. I mentioned earlier that shortening the duration of the flu had the possible benefit of decreasing secondary infections. Unfortunately, users of Tamiflu report a higher rate of secondary infections than non-users. Now, my family and I will not be taking Tamiflu or Relenza. If you haven't made an educated decision on the subject, I strongly encourage you to research the subject so that you will be confident in your decision and can defend it to people who are on the opposite side of the issue of you, regardless of which side that is. I'm not anti-drug, I'm not anti-big pharma, and I'm not anti-doctor. In fact, I'm quite thankful for all of them. And when you think about it, many drugs are simply vitamins or substances taken from nature and repackaged. That being said, I tend to like treatments with as few side effects as possible, treatments with as little big brother record keeping as possible, treatments that are easy to find, treatments that don't require me to sit in a room full of sick people, and treatments that don't require me to pay someone to give me permission to take the treatment. It's just personal. You may or may not agree with that. So here are some proven ways to prevent and fight the flu. As I said earlier, a healthy immune system is key to fighting off the flu and getting over it quickly if you do get it, even if you do take an antiviral medicine. Fortunately, there are several cheap, simple ways to strengthen your immune system to keep from getting the flu and fight it if you or a loved one comes down with it. Amazingly, one of the most effective ways to keep from getting the flu is with vitamin D exposure through the sun. For a fair-skinned person, 15 minutes of sun exposure without sunscreen will give you 10 to 20,000 international units compared to a recommended daily allowance of only 400. As an example, you get approximately 100 international units from a glass of milk. Well, how does this work? Well, it's really pretty cool. Vitamin D is converted into a hormone. It's called calcitriol in the kidneys, and I may have butchered that name, but it's spelled C-A-L-C-I-T-R-I-O-L. And it increases the body's production of antimicrobial peptides. And these peptides destroy the cell walls of bacteria, fungi, and viruses, including the influenza virus. Now, it's important to note that not all vitamin Ds are created equal. Most supplements are vitamin D2, but the form of vitamin D created by the body when exposed to the sun is vitamin D3. Both D2 and D3 are converted to their more usable form in the body, but D3 converts 500% faster and binds with proteins more effectively than D2 does. The effectiveness of vitamin D3 in fighting viruses has been studied since the 60s, and the link between the winter solstice and the flu was first put forth by R. Edgar Holt Simpson in 1981. Sunlight, and in particular vitamin D3, is believed to be the main reason why the flu is worst in the fall and winter in stormy years among people who spend the majority of their time indoors. The connection was made stronger when researchers studied the Inuit. Their diet consists primarily of fish high in vitamin D3, and they stay healthy through the winter months despite less sun exposure. One of the possible reasons that the 1918 H1N1 flu was so deadly is that it caused cytokine storms. Cytokine storms can be oversimplified as the body's immune system overreacting and attacking the body and liquefying the organs. Now, fortunately, vitamin D3 is a very effective drug for immune response in general and preventing cytokine storms in particular. Now, there's something that I want you to do after reading this, or right now. Make a point to start spending 10 to 20 minutes outside every day without sunscreen on. While getting 10 to 20 minutes of sun exposure every day is the easiest thing you can do to improve your immune system, it's also the easiest thing to forget to do or to postpone. One strategy that will help you is to put an S on your calendar for the next 30 days. Every day that you get 10 to 20 minutes of sun exposure, cross through the S. All right, back to the lesson. This is really important. I want you to realize that this entire course costs less than one dose of Tamiflu, and you just learned a free way to dramatically lower your chances of catching the flu. Now, in an earlier chapter, I suggested contacting Joe Mercola's clinic in Chicago if you're on any long-term prescription medications. If you haven't yet, I really encourage you to do so. And that website, again, is naturalhealthcenter.mercola, and that's mercola.com. Joe is a licensed physician and surgeon whose focus is primarily on non-prescription solutions to medical issues. To be frank, we don't always see eye to eye on political and non-medical topics, but Joe has helped me tremendously over the last 4 years with health and wellness. Joe has not had the flu in over 20 years and has suggested 8 simple and inexpensive ways to dramatically improve your immune system. Number 1, vitamin D through daily sun exposure. Number 2, avoid sugar and processed foods. Number 3, get enough rest, in particular so that you don't need caffeine to function. Getting less than 6 hours of sleep each night increases your chance of contracting illnesses by as much as 300%. Control stress through prayer, meditation, or EFT. Exercise. Make sure and take omega-3 daily from fish or high-quality fish oil or from krill oil. Next, wash your hands thoroughly throughout the day. And finally, eat garlic if you're able to. And by that, I mean if you're not allergic to it. Some additional strategies and dietary aids for you to consider for boosting your immune system and helping keep you healthy are the following. The first one is probiotics. And if you're not familiar with them, probiotics will replenish the good bacteria supply in your gut, and they'll help you get more nutrients out of the food that you eat. In addition, these good bacteria will help your body fight off bad bacteria. Now, I'll include a link to the best source I've found on the resource page for this lesson. Number 2 is echinacea, and echinacea boosts the immune system by increasing the white blood cell counts. Number 3 is astragalus, and it's an effective herb that you can take to strengthen your immune system before getting ill, but many professionals suggest that you don't take it once you're sick. Number 4 is stop smoking, and I won't nag you on this. If you're addicted to nicotine, you're probably already trying to quit. Number 5, limit caffeine intake to 1 glass of coffee per day. Once you get through the withdrawal, you'll have more energy, not less. You'll have a lower stress level, and you'll be able to sleep better. Number 6, use a paper towel when leaving bathrooms to open doors after you wash and dry your hands. Many places now have trash cans by the door for this purpose. If not, you can always carry a towel for a few seconds until you can throw it away. Number 7, carry a pen with you to sign credit and debit card receipts rather than using a common pen at store registers. Okay, what if you get the flu? Sometimes life throws you curveballs. You might have a big project at work, a teething or colicky baby, family or financial issues, an injury, or something else that's outside of your control that affects your sleep and immune system. That's life. If this happens during flu season and you do get the flu, don't panic. There are tried and tested ways to fight off infections that are cheap and effective. Keep in mind that this is your life and or the life of a loved one that you're dealing with. If the virus that you get is killing people within 2 to 3 days of becoming symptomatic, I don't know how long I'd wait before trying to go to a doctor. And I'm not going to tell you how long to wait. In fact, many quote-unquote public advocacy groups are working various media channels to try and get the message out that supplements and herbal remedies will not help you and that your only hope is to get to a doctor and buy Tamiflu. I'll let you decide. But the fact is, if a third of your city is coming down with a killer flu, you may not be able to get an appointment with a doctor, and you may not be accepted to an ER, even if you want to go. If you do get in, there may not be any prescriptions available. Simply put, you can buy all of the items listed below for under $100. If you get the flu, you want to go to a doctor, and you're able to, then you haven't lost anything. You still have the items. They've got long shelf lives, and you can always use them in the future. But if doctor's offices and ERs aren't taking new patients, or if there's a breakdown in civil order, you better have another option ready to go. Now, I keep all of these items on hand, and my wife, myself, and our toddler use them when we get under the weather. Don't let their simplicity fool you. They're very effective. Again, many prescriptions are simply vitamins or naturally occurring substances that are sold as prescriptions. So, in addition to continuing to get daily sun exposure, one of the non-prescription strategies is taking 10 milligrams of zinc daily. And this can be from your multivitamin, lozenges, or sprays. A good guide to use is that if you feel nauseous after taking zinc, it's a good sign that you've already got enough in your system and you should stop taking any more for a while. Next, a simple and effective treatment for respiratory infections like the flu in general, and pneumonia in particular, is the use of high-quality oregano, thyme, and rosewood oils. And I know that sounds kind of hooey, but it really works. You can put 5 to 10 drops of each in a warm bath, 5 to 10 drops of each in a steaming bowl of water and breathe in the steam, or 5 to 10 drops in a humidifier. Again, this is something that if you can't get to a doctor, if you can't get to an ER, this may be your only shot. And the stuff has worked for literally thousands of people. And it may or may not work for you. Antibiotics may or may not work for you. But it's worth a try. It's very inexpensive to try this. Next, a personal treatment that cured a case of drug-resistant pneumonia that I contracted in the hospital. And it nearly killed me. And it's also helped me with other minor illnesses through the years, is a combination of grapefruit seed extract, tea tree oil, and colloidal gold. And I'll include a link to the best source for that that I've found on the resource page for this lesson. One very effective supplement for upper respiratory infections is elderberry or sambucol. It's a natural antiviral, and you can get it in either liquid or tablet form. And you can even get elder zinc lozenges that have both elderberry and zinc together. Again, echinacea boosts the immune system by increasing white blood cell counts. Simply increase your dosage when you start getting ill. And finally, this is somewhat controversial, but stop taking antacids. The incidence of pneumonia are 4 times higher among people who take Nexium, Prevacid, Pepcid, and Zantac than the general public. Now, stress was a considerable part of that equation, but current users still have an 89% higher chance of contracting pneumonia than former users. Some of these treatments may be a little far out for you. If so, please research the ones that you have the most trouble with. When you do, I think you'll agree that they're worth trying. We found that it's very empowering to catch a bug at the same time as a friend, to be able to treat it ourselves while they go to the doctor and get a prescription, and to end up feeling better before they do. Again, even if you intend to go directly to a doctor if you get the flu, I encourage you to study these alternatives and have some or all of them on hand. It could be very important, especially if there's a pandemic, people are dying, you get sick, and timely professional medical attention is not an option. I really want you to go over to the resource page for this chapter. It's at urbansurvivalplan.com/193. There's some great resources there that I mentioned in the chapter, as well as feedback from other students who have completed this lesson.